The title anomaly we discussed the last two classes is deeply connected to the zero modes of the Dirac operator. And to see why that's the case, we can note that the non-zero eigenvalues of the Dirac operator come in pairs. We act with the Dirac operator on gamma 5 times one of our eigenfunctions. We can use the anti-commutation relations for gamma 5 and gamma mu. This is minus I gamma 5. I d slash psi n, which is minus lambda n, m5 psi n. So these, if phi n is non-zero, then phi n and gamma 5 by n are orthogonal. Because they're eigenfunctions with different eigenvalues. So that means that the anomaly that we were looking at last time is related to this integral. We could write it as a trace of gamma 5, essentially, is this the integral of the sum of the eigenfunctions times gamma 5 times the eigen. So most of the terms in the sum don't actually contribute, because gamma 5 phi n is orthogonal to phi n, unless lambda n is 0. So this is really telling us something just about the zero modes, or eigenfunctions with zero eigenvalue, the Dirac operator. So we can write this sum as just the sum over zero modes. And we can go further than this, because gamma 5 just has two eigenvalues, plus or minus 1. So each term in the sum either gives us plus 1 or minus 1, depending on whether phi n is a positive or negative eigenvalue, is a positive or negative eigenvalue under gamma phi. So our trace gamma 5 is just the difference in the number of zero modes with positive eigenvalue minus the number of zero modes with negative eigenvalue. So this anomaly, trace of gamma 5, I dropped out the theta we had here before, but essentially just went along for the ride. It's an integer.
Okay.
Yes.
Why do the zero modes have to be eigenmodes of gamma 5? If we are saying n plus is...
Right.
Zero modes with eigenvalue plus one or something. But
why do they have to be eigenvalues of?
This is fine. Yeah.
MFR.
I realized because they are eigenvectors of different lambda, so they'll be orthogonal in the final step.
Mm-hmm.
When we come, I understand that it's summation over all zero modes. But then why will it be n plus minus n minus?
Oh, so gamma 5 times by n is plus or minus by n. This is an eigenvalue, eigenfunction with eigenvalue 1, a plus or minus 1.
That is my question. Why is phi n is an eigenvector of the Dirac operator? But why is phi n?
But I think d/ commutes with phi n, gamma 5, right?
Yes, that's the first
so,
part
mm-hmm.
is clear.
So we
oh,
can
okay, okay.
Yes.
Do they d/ commutes? D/
they anti commute.
Oh,
it's not
yeah,
commutes.
So.
Otherwise, the first argument won't work.
That's true.
So, but what I don't understand is why is phi n an eigenvector of gamma 5? Because only then you can say that
right.
gamma 5 phi n is either plus minus phi n, right?
Right. Yes, so that's... These are eigenfunctions of the Dirac.
Yeah.
So we can find a can simultaneously eigenize these for the zero modes. So
why can we simultaneously find?
We could just write phi n as a sum of like a left and right handed piece, and then maybe that would.
Yeah, but then that does not become plus or minus phi n.
The cross terms would vanish, and then it's all diagonal. Because in the chiral basis, gamma 5 is diagonal. So if you just write phi in the chiral basis, then the cross term should vanish, right?
Right, so
left-handed diagonal,
projection,
right-handed is zero.
The PL and PR are projection operators. All right, one is projection operator on.
Yeah.
Apply that to phi n, the cross term PLPR is zero.
If you write like gamma 5 is PL minus PR even.
Right.
And then you get the minus sign to pop out.
Oh, maybe the gamma. We will write phi n as some phi n right, phi n left, plus phi n left. And then gamma 5 acting on phi n plus will give us either plus or minus. And then you're saying the cross terms
will cancel. Exactly.
That can work, yeah.
Also, I have another question. But trace of gamma 5, how it has the special, like the, what was the word? I thought it should be zero because it's just a matrix. It doesn't depend on a coordinate, right? It's not dependent on x.
Right.
So it just normal trace. It's not like that. Because before we had like theta x gamma 5.
That
trace.
Yes. So if you like, I can put a trace here. So this capital PR means the matrix and functional trace.
Yeah, but the functional part is separated, right? Because
those two parts.
Identity.
Yeah, those two parts factorize regardless of whether I put the theta here or not.
Mm-hmm.
So it's. It's zero times infinity without a regulator.
It's kind of like the identity, functional identity, which has, again, infinite trace. Here we have zero trace, so we need, again, regulator or something like that.
That's right. That's right. So this anomaly is in fact, an integer. And there's a famous result in topology that called the index, this operator, or the number of n plus minus n minus the number of positive eigenvalue, zero modes with positive eigenvalue minus the number of zero modes with negative eigenvalue is equal to the anomaly we found last time. This is known as the Atiyah-Singer index theorem. And so this index is the n plus minus n minus, and it's an integer. Which tells us very importantly that this result, or at least strongly suggests, you can prove it, but strongly suggests that the anomaly that we computed before is exact. This depends on the gauge coupling, E. It's very hard to imagine how we could add additional terms that have depend on E in a different way to this term, so that we always get an integer for any value of the coupling. That alone is strong evidence that it's top. This is an exact topological result. I mean, can be shown. That's true. Also, if we think about our derivation using functional integrals, we did not explicitly use perturbation theory, so our result is exact. The anomaly is something that does show up in perturbation theory. You can compute it from one-loop Feynman diagrams. In that derivation, it's not at all clear that this is an exact result. It seems like you should be able to get corrections, but this result essentially tells us that there are no further corrections. The anomaly is one loop exact. Just a brief word on how where the anomaly shows up in Feynman diagrams. So in four dimensions, Feynman diagrams you want to consider are triangle diagrams, where we couple at one vertex to the chiral current, and at the other vertices to the vector current. I won't say a lot about this, but just a few words about why this is, might be the right thing to compute. So one is it involves gamma 5, so you've got the chiral current here. Second reason is that we will get sufficiently many gamma matrices. So J mu has gamma matrices. There's also gamma matrices in the fermion propagators. And if we want to have a trace involving with gamma 5 and it's non-zero in four dimensions, we need at least four gamma matrices. This diagram has at least four gamma matrices. Additionally, it's divergent. This, or at least, we do a naive counting. We have three fermion propagators and one loop. So the fermion propagators go like one over p. So this is naively divergent. The regulators will play an important role in this diagram. So that suggests that certainly there's more to say. It's a much longer story to try to derive the anomaly in using Feynman diagrams and perturbation theory, but the correct way to do it is this, and these are some reasons why you might want to consider. consider this. I won't say too much more about that.
Then does this three-photon diagram vanish identically?
No, it doesn't. That's what you would expect classically.
Oh, I see.
You'd expect classically, at least if you contracted this diagram with a momentum. In other words, if you took a derivative of this with respect to any of these external currents, it would vanish. That would be the Ward identity that you would expect classically. But we've seen that the chiral current is not conserved.
I see.
So we can track this diagram with one of the external momenta, we won't get zero. I will get something proportional to the anomaly.
I see.
So here three gammas are from the Feynman propagators, and the fourth one is?
Is from the J mu's will also have. So there's actually five here, and then there's some cancellations here. So it's a longer story. I just want to say that you can compute it this way. So some rough motivation for why that's the right thing. Okay. And in this picture, this fact that this is exact is not at all obvious. Okay. So if there are further questions on the chiral anomaly, I'd like to move on to gauge anomalies. Yes, Charlie.
Just before we move on, I guess it's still not, like, I understand why it's an integer just based on the zero modes argument, but just, you know, the dependence on n plus and n minus on the actual gauge field itself is a little more confusing to me. Like, what, I guess I was just hoping maybe there's just like a little more to say about how changing the gauge field introduces new zero modes, et cetera. And how many there are. I guess I'm still a little confused, because we saw before that, like, you know, if we just had the vector potential point in the opposite direction, then
right.
there's the other zero mode instead of the old zero mode. And I guess I'm just confused.
Well, so our earlier discussion was in terms of the energy levels. So we were looking at the energy levels, so the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, not of the Dirac operator.
Right.
We were considering something a bit different. Or the proof of this theorem is not trivial. So it's not something I can explain in a couple of minutes.
Maybe it's worth just moving on then.
Okay. Okay, so next topic I'd like to discuss is gauge anomalies. And so our starting point will be a non-abelian gauge theory with a single chiral fermion. We'll assume our Lagrangian takes this form. We've got a chiral fermion, assume it's a left-handed fermion. Work very similarly if it was right-handed. And let's suppose it lives in some representation of a non-abelian gauge group. We won't need to assume much about which representation it lives in. And we've got our gauge kinetic term. Okay, so here, this is a chiral fermion. So psi L is our projection operator. So much of the story for gauge anomalies is very similar to what we discussed for chiral anomalies. So gauge invariants tells us that our Lagrangian is invariant if we do a gauge transformation. So if we transform psi L e to the I beta I x e I psi L, I can call this u psi L, and then the gauge field will also transform. So this is almost identical to the transformation law we looked at before. Difference, we have a generator of the gauge group here, and the gauge field transforms on here. So there's an associated conserved current to the global subgroup of this gauge symmetry. And Noether's theorem tells us that that conserved current is almost exactly what we had before, except we have TA here. This is a conserved current. And note that it's not gauge invariant. It's not directly observable. There's one way in which the conservation of this current is different than it was for the case of the chiral current. And that's that this conservation of this current is connected to the equation of motion for the gauge field. So the equation of motion for E mu is at the derivative of Lagrangian respect to A mu A is dl d A mu A. And with this Lagrangian, that gives us 1 over g squared d nu f nu nu A is equal to psi bar L MMU TA psi L. And notice that the right-hand side of this equation, the derivative of this Lagrangian respect to A MU A is exactly conserved current. And we can apply covariant derivative to this equation. And if we apply the covariant derivative, this equation, well, the left-hand side vanishes. We're contracting a symmetric combination of covariant derivatives with an anti-symmetric field strength tensor. So this is zero. So we get that zero is equal to d mu KL mu A.
Sorry, Dan.
Yeah, right?
Shouldn't there be a curvature term?
Yeah, that's it.
Because the covariant derivatives.
That not symmetric.
Where?
You said for it to be zero, d mu had to commute, but they don't commute. A covariant derivative.
Right.
Should be like f squared or something.
Mm-hmm. this.
F is anti-symmetric.
Should be zero.
An anti-symmetric contracted with an anti-symmetric should.
Okay, so okay, maybe there's additional steps in here. The end result is correct.
I can believe that.
Okay. So the covariant conservation of the conserved current follows from the equations of motion. And if this equation is corrected, we need to worry about whether the equations of motion are correct. That's a very different situation from the chiral current conservation. Chiral current conservation, we had an equations of motion, which were satisfied, but what we were worrying about was whether or not the current was conserved or not. So that could lead to interesting physics. It did lead to interesting physics when it's not conserved. Here, if this equation has corrections, should be deeply concerned about whether our equations of motions are correct. And that, particularly for a gauge theory, is crucial for the quantization to work. So if the equations of motion are corrected, that suggests that we need extra terms in the Lagrangian. And in general, those could spoil gauge invariance, renormalizability, and unitary of the theory. So this equation is far more important to the consistency of this quantum theory than our conservation equation was before when we were considering the chiral current. So this is essential for consistency. Unlike chiral current conservation. And well, so we can essentially repeat the same derivation we did before using functional integrals. I'll have a few comments on the changes, but the end result, the procedure is mostly the same. There are a few small differences. The end result is that if you carry out the same procedure we went through last time, we find a correction to that equation. So the correct equation is that I won't write down the whole thing. It's rather long and complicated, but it's something proportional to a trace of the product of the generators of the representation of the fermion. It's coupled to the gauge field. So this is TA, and then the anti-symmetrized product of TB and TC. So this part here will depend on the gauge field. And so we want this term to be zero. This anomaly to be zero, that depends on the representation of the fermion, lives in. It lives in a representation where this trace vanishes, or we have several contributions from several fermions, several chiral fermions, and the sum of those contributions vanishes, then our equation of motion is correct. If not, if the sum over fermions of this trace doesn't vanish, then our theory is sick. It's inconsistent. Our equations of motion for the gauge field are wrong.
Yeah.
Yes.
Sure. Is that a symmetrization or an anti-symmetrization?
Symmetrization. Yes. Symmetrized trace.
So that's a little confusing to me, just because when I look at the way I would interpret it is T A B C is like one direction for the loop, but then T C B A C B would be the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
You pick up a minus sign because of fermion loop, versus like exchange of stuff.
There is another minus sign.
Yes. Get a minus sign from.
Oh, because you are changing fermions to anti-fermions. This gives it.
So there's like two minus signs that turn into a plus sign?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
So.
See it as like the exchange of two of the J mu's, which are bosons. So
yeah, you can also view it that way.
Right. That makes sense when I think about it that way.
Okay, so the consistency of the theory depends on the fermion content. Okay, so I'm not going to go through the whole functional integral derivation again. Just want to make a few comments on what changes from our derivation before. So if we want to derive this using functional integrals, well, one obvious change is that there'll be lots of factors of T floating around, generators of the representation of the fermion. So that part is less interesting. Perhaps more about is that the chiral coupling of the fermion to the gauge field complicates the eigenfunction expansion. And the basic reason for that is that I D slash PL is not Hermitian.
Are we still in Euclidean space?
We're still in Euclidean space. So even in Euclidean space, this is not Hermitian. And so let's take a look at the relevant functional integral in this case and see what the difference is. So again, in Euclidean, and again, treating the gauge field as a classical background field, the relevant functional integral is the integral over the fermion fields. These are chiral now. This is d by l, d by l bar. We've got e to the minus pi bar l I e slash psi l. Okay. We might. So we're not integrating over the gauge field, so I don't need to worry about the gauge kinetic term. This is the relevant part of the integral to see this effect. So naively, we expect this is an integral we can actually do exactly. This is a Gaussian integral in terms of the fermion fields. We might think this is proportional to the determinant by d slash. Yeah. That's the operator that appears.
Sorry, can I ask one more thing? Why do we not put a PL on the left as well? Does it matter?
So PL. PL I D select. So this is a projection operator.
Oh, does it commutes?
It commutes.
Okay, never mind then.
So that's equal to.
Sure.
Can you elaborate a bit at why it's not Hermitian? Because it's kind of the derivative, I derivative thing that we already had, right? And all the time this thing was Hermitian. Now what happened to the operator? Because it's leaves on the same thing that we already had.
Okay, so, yes. So basically what's going on? Oh, sorry, this is not right. This should be PR. It's because we have a, this is a BART. Because we've got a gamma zero hiding. So what is going on here is, and so that's related to your question. If we take the conjugate Hermitian conjugate of this, ID slash is Hermitian, and we'll end up with a PL on the other side. And if we commute it back, we got PR.
And then also, but we expect the determinant to be, because usual Gaussian integral, the fields that are integrated over, those are the fields that appear in the integral, in the exponential, and that's also happening here. Why do we need extra PLs and PRs in the determinant?
I think the problem is definition of d slash, right? When we write d slash there, we mean it's already truncated, right? Because it runs on one side. I think it's just the definition of d slash.
Yeah, in a sense. So this would be okay if we were integrating over both components of the field. But the problem is here we're trying to construct a theory that only has left-handed fermions. But the operator ID slash PL it's equal to IPR D slash. And this maps left-handed fermions to right-handed fermions. So it maps to something that's not even part of our Hilbert space. So it's not even clear if this integral exists. We're mapping a left-handed fermion to a right-handed fermion. So there's a problem here. At least if we try to repeat what we did four in terms of working in an eigenbasis of operator. And so one resolution to this is to instead work in an eigenbasis of I D slash EL dagger I D slash EL. So this maps psi, a left-handed fermion, the left-handed fermion, and it's explicitly Hermitian. So we can instead work in an eigenbasis of this operator.
I want to just check something about my understanding. If I add PL behind that psi L, which is on the power of exponential, nothing happens, right? It's still the same. If
that's
I
right. I can I can sort of PL here.
Because
that's,
it's already projected.
It's already projected.
That's
PL.
Why we have determinants there.
That's right. PL squared is PL, projection operator. So we can work in an eigenbasis of this operator. This operator maps psi L to psi L formation. It works. And if we squared this, or took this functional integral times its conjugate, we could you use that to define the, we get the determinant of I EL dagger, ID slash EL. This is something, this determinant is well-defined in gauge invariant. If it exists, that should be the magnitude of the determinant of I E slash EL squared. It's not clear if this exists. And so in this sense, because this is an operator we can define, and define its determinant. This is the operator we're trying to, whose determinant we're trying to compute. It's not clear if this exists because of these problems. But the problem is limited in the sense that what we can't define necessarily is the phase of this determinant. There's an ambiguity in the phase. And that phase is connected to the gauge anomaly. So in terms of the functional integral, there's a gauge anomaly. The phase is ambiguous. Or another way of putting that, we want to rephrase things in terms of instead of z generating functional for all diagrams, we could rewrite it in terms of the effective potential gamma. And so an ambiguity in the phase of z leads to an ambiguity in the imaginary part of gamma.
Dan, could you connect again? Why? So what phase are we talking about, and why from this step there is a ambiguity in phase?
Well, so. This is an operator we can define. This operator, well defined, it maps Hermitian, it maps our function space to our function space. So we can could repeat this procedure, but with this operator, it's a quadratic operator instead of ID slash, which is the one we're interested in. And we'd have no problems then.
Okay.
And so we could use this equation here to define the magnitude of the determinant of the operator we're interested in, ID slash PL,
okay.
But not necessarily the phase.
So, but okay, we are saying that if it exists, both of them will be equal. And
yes.
Okay, so we could, in principle, determinant of what we want is, say, under root of that, the modulus, but we don't know what the phase will be.
That's right.
Okay, I see.
I just want to make sure I understand. This determinant squared thing, that is actually what we would get if we also included right-handed fermions as well, because that ID slash PL would become an ID slash PR, and if you sort of do the left and right sectors separately, they would combine anyways.
So in that, this is not quite the same thing as what we would compute if we just had a non-chiral fermion or included right-handed fermions. Then we would include integrals over the right-handed fermions as well, and we wouldn't have the projection operators.
You could still split it up into like psi bar ID slash psi into the left and right handed pieces and do each Gaussian integral separately and still get that.
We could. Yes, the individual operators wouldn't be Hermitian, but it'd still work out in the end. It'd be more complicated than the case we looked at before. But this problem of mapping to a field that's outside of our space, it wouldn't appear. We had both on the right. Yeah. And
is here also, even for the magnitude, we used a trick to fix the magnitude. What tells us that there is no trick to fix the phase? Which we are saying we can fix the magnitude, but we can't fix the phase, and therefore there is ambiguity.
There's an ambiguity in general, and there's an ambiguity exactly when this trace doesn't vanish. If this trace doesn't vanish, you can get around. I'm not going to show that, but you can get around this ambiguity. Everything's well defined. But this ambiguity cannot be resolved if there's an anomaly. These two things are equally connected. Okay. So then, given this, whether you can consistently define a gauge theory depends on the fermion content of your theory. So if you have some fermion contents, tell me whether they're chiral fermions and which representations they live in of which gauge groups. That will determine whether or not there's a gauge anomaly, whether we can define the theory consistently. There are some cases where it's simple to tell whether a particular fermion contributes to the anomaly. So one case is fermions in real or pseudo-real representations do not contribute. So the pseudo real representation means that T transpose is equal to minus V TL times V for some unitary V. And it's real if V is the identity. So that you plug this into the symmetrized trace of the generators, you can show a few lines that vanish. And there are a number of gauge groups that only have real or pseudo real representations. Another important case where they don't contribute are massive fermions. Or more precisely, fermions that have fermions in a theory where the symmetries of the theory allow a mass term. You can have massive fermions that whose masses are generated by spontaneous symmetry breaking or other effects where a direct mass term is forbidden, and those can contribute to the anomaly. But if the symmetries of the theory allow for a mass term, then it will not contribute. So there are two cases. One is we have a Dirac fermion. Then it's clear we don't have a chiral fermion, so we're not going to have this problem. We can also think about it as having both a left and a right-handed fermion in the same representation, and the contributions will cancel. But it's also true for Majorana fermions, Majorana mass terms. Essentially because Majorana mass terms, Majorana fermions always live in real representations. So those are the two most important cases that don't contribute, but you can also look at particular gauge groups, and there's a few comments about that in the notes. These also do not contribute. Okay. So just to wrap up, my extremely brief summary. We have two kinds of anomalies. I remember one thing. Remember from this part of the course. To elaborate slightly, chiral anomalies. They're a feature of the theory. They can explain experiments. They lead to interesting physics that connect the UV and the IR. It's a global symmetry that is a symmetry, becomes a symmetry of the theory in the h bar goes to zero limit. So classical mechanics is an approximation, quantum mechanics in that limit. There's no reason that we expect the reverse if we have an approximation to a theory that that describes everything that the full theory does. So this is something new. It's not present in classical physics. It is present in quantum mechanics. Gauge anomalies are, in a sense, very similar. They arise in both cases through the non-invariance of the measure. But they are, in another sense, very different. Gauge anomalies signal a inconsistency of the theory. The equations of motion are not valid, loss of unitarity, loss of renormalizability. These are problems, but gauge anomalies are determined by the fermion constant of the theory. And so they can place interesting constraints on the fermion conscious of the theory. And you can even match, use this to match or put constraints on dualities between different gauge theories, different fermion contents. There's some interesting work. Or you can use it to put constraints on beyond the standard model physics. If you have a beyond the standard model physics and you want to add an extra fermion, that may or may not be consistent. And you add extra fermions if you want to have a gauge theory with the known standard model particles plus one new fermion.
So it feels like in both cases, what's still important is just the fact that we have chiral fermions and these are transforming differently, right?
Yes.
So I'm just wondering if we had like an odd number of space-time dimensions, does worrying about anomalies just kind of go away? Because you can only have chiral fermions in an even space-time dimension, right?
That's right.
They only matter in even dimensions?
Yes. The anomalies I've described here only occur in even dimensions where we can define chirality. You can connect the topology in even and odd dimensions. So as I mentioned before, that the anomaly is a topological effect, the chiral anomaly is, and that can be connected to the topology of theories in odd dimensions. There are some relations there.
I guess that makes sense.
Okay.
The whole framework is what this tells us, that if for certain fermion content, this kind of, say, QFT is not consistent. So what is more, how do we decide what is more fundamental? Like you said, you putting constraints on the fermion content based on whether the QFT is consistent or not. But couldn't it be the other way around also, that maybe we just don't have the right description yet for some kind of fermions?
That's possible. That's possible too. It signals, yes, that there are other possible resolutions. It signals there's something wrong with our understanding. That theory does not make sense in our current framework. Modified in the UV, maybe it makes sense in another way. So thank you very much. So next week we'll go on to CFT.